Okay, so I want to start by thanking you for the introduction, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to this beautiful venue to share with you some of my group's work. To those of you who don't know me, my name is Abhay Pasupathi, and I'm here from Columbia University in New York City. Good. I'm still Abhay Pasupathi, even for those people. Okay, so here's an outline of what I will tell you today. I will start with discussing nematicity or anisotropy as we can see it in STM experiments. And I will tell you how we actually see it in our experiment. And I'll give you a simple explanation for what we see. As far as I know, it's a correct explanation. Nobody has proved to me otherwise, but we'll see. And then I'll talk a little bit about the case of nematic order versus nematic fluctuations and what one sees in each of those cases in STM. This is for the most part fairly now old, as in 3 or 4 years old work, but I will update it with some more recent experiments that we've done along this line. And all of this will be done on the compound sodium iron arsenide, mostly on the undoped and the underdoped side of this compound. So after this, I will dive into superconductivity and its interplay with nematicity. And here I'll focus on underdoped and optimally doped sodium ion arsenide. This is doping with cobalt. And I will just tell you about two different things. One is what happens when I have a nematically ordered state and the sample goes superconducting. And then something that's quite different, what happens when I have a state, a normal state, where the nematic fluctuations exist and these are strong and superconducting order sets in. What happens then in the STM? Okay, so finally in the third half of this talk, which I hope I get to, I will talk about something that's been sort of a personal craze of mine for the last couple of years, which is how can we tune anisotropic phenomena in solids? And guided by lots of interesting work in these compounds and in other compounds, we've made techniques where we can apply uniaxial strain or uniaxial pressure and measure their properties in STM or transport or ARPES or whatnot. I'll talk about STM data on sodium ion arsenide. I'll very briefly, if I have time, touch on some transport data, not in sodium ion arsenide. Okay, I think we will have several STM talks in this meeting. Since I'm the first one, I'll give you the one or two slide introduction to STM. So STM, as you all know by now, is a technique by which you bring a sharp metal tip close to a surface. You bring it about 5 angstroms or so away from the surface. If you do that, electrons can tunnel between the tip and the surface. And the number of ways they can tunnel, or the tunneling current, is proportional to how many states exist. Fermi's golden rule. And this is the basic principle behind which we operate. The current, or the conductance, of this junction is proportional to the density of states of your sample, which is the interesting object to measure. Okay, so just to orient you, if you haven't seen these kinds of images before, let me give you an example of how STM data is commonly presented. So the details of this experiment are unimportant. What I want you to take away from this experiment is that this is basically a little quantum dot. And in this quantum dot, electrons are confined. And if electrons are confined in this sort of circular-ish quantum dot, you all know what the states of the electron are. They're bound states. There's a ground state, there's a first excited state, there's a second excited state, and so on. And STM data we can take in one of two ways. I can sit at a particular location inside this sample. I can measure the density of states as a function of energy. If you do that, you will see curves like these various curves. Or I can pick a particular energy, and I can plot everywhere in space what the density of states looks like. Right? And of course, if you do this at the ground state, you see the ground state wave function. You do this for the first excited state, you see the first excited state wave function, and so on and so forth. So in this talk, I'll exclusively present data that's of this form. So what you should remember is when I show you a picture like this, I'm showing you roughly what the electronic wave functions look like at a particular energy. Okay, so let's get right to it. I'm going to talk about one particular compound, sodium ion arsenide. This particular compound has a phase diagram that looks like this. Everywhere in this white region of the phase diagram, the material is nominally tetragonal and paramagnetic. As I cool down below a first transition temperature, which is 50 Kelvin for my undoped sample, the sample undergoes an orthorhombic distortion where one direction becomes longer than the other direction, but the sample is still paramagnetic. And as I cool below a second temperature, which is 40 Kelvin for my sample, spin density wave order sets in with this famous spin density wave that's commonly seen in the nictites. Now, what's special in this compound is that this difference is 10 Kelvin, which is quite unusual for the nictites. And this was originally pointed out by Raphael in the days of his youth when he was at Columbia, which set us off on measuring this compound. Okay, so how do you see nematicity in STM? So I show you here a picture which shows you nematicity or anisotropy. So this is an STM image at a particular energy. The energy is close to the Fermi level. If you look at this picture, you very clearly see that there's some streaks in this image. And all of these streaks in this image are all pointed along one particular direction. So they very clearly break fourfold rotational symmetry. Right? So whenever I talk about nematicity or anisotropy, this is what I mean. You see features in the STM that point along a particular direction. Now, if you zoom in along one of those features, you see something that looks like this. The size scale of this feature for sodium ion arsenide is about 16 lattice constants or so. And it's quite interesting that if you look across a lot of nictite families, you see something very, very similar. And even the size scales are very similar. Okay, so one can look at this anisotropy or nematicity either in real space. So here is a picture in real space around, I forgot to mention something. What I should say is that we see associated with each of these streaks, there is a defect in the crystal. So wherever we see a defect in a crystal, we see one of these features pinned to the defect, and it doesn't matter what that defect is. Okay, so I can look in real space, I can look at one of these objects, and you can see that it looks, the intensity along this axis is very different from the intensity along this axis. Or I can take a Fourier transform of this image. If I take a Fourier transform of this image, looks something like this, you can see that the intensity along this axis is very different from the intensity along the opposite axis, or 90 degree axis. And if you wish, you can quantify this in various ways. One of the ways we like to do it is to take the same image, subtract it from its 90 degree rotated variant, and if it's fourfold rotational symmetric, then when you do the subtraction procedure, you get zero. Good. So now the next thing I want to spend a little bit of time is to explain why is it that we see this kind of structure around defects in sodium ion arsenide. And this goes back to something that's by now quite popular. Perhaps I don't need to go into it at any detail. It comes down to what happens when you have a defect in a crystal which has bands. So if I have a defect in a crystal, then the electrons in the material come and scatter off of the crystal. Electrons come in with momentum Ki, they go out with momentum Kf. And in general, the incoming and outgoing wave scatter against each other, and they produce some pattern in space. And these days, it's called quasi-particle interference, very much related to the physics of Friedel oscillations. If you look in real space, then you realize that the wave vectors that you see in the image, in an STM image, are related to the difference Ki minus Kf of the incoming and outgoing electron wave, just like any interference phenomenon. Okay, let me give you one more slide of how this works in a very simple material. So if you take a very simple material with a very simple Fermi surface, this could be the surface of gold or copper, which has such a circular Fermi surface. If you have a defect in the material and you scatter off of this defect and you ask what are all the wave vectors that are observed, then this is the Fermi surface. And so any defect can produce scatterings that take you, for example, from this wave vector to this wave vector. And that would give you a feature that's along that particular wave vector, which I plot here. And of course, if I have all possible scatterings allowed, then all of these wave vectors will be allowed. And in general, it doesn't take much thought to realize that if I take a disk of radius Kf, this produces in my scattering pattern a disk of radius twice Kf, famous 2Kf scattering. And this has now been seen many, many times, I think starting with Mike Cromie in the early 90s. So this is a photo emission experiment, And here is the STM experiment showing you that 2 kF. Very good. So now we want to apply the same physics to the case of sodium ion arsenide, which doesn't have a simple circular Fermi surface. So what we did is we went to the Fermi surfaces of nictides, and this is roughly a cartoon of the Fermi surface of sodium ion arsenide. And this particular cartoon of the Fermi surface is somewhere in this white region up here at high temperature in the paramagnetic phase. So in the paramagnetic phase, the Fermi surface has four-fold rotational symmetry. It doesn't have anything funky like gaps or so on and so forth. I can just apply this principle that I told you about earlier with this slightly more complicated Fermi surface, and I can ask what wave vectors would I see in my STM image. This is all of those wave vectors. You can see that this is the experiment. This is what one would expect from this particular Fermi surface. They look nothing like each other. I can then look at a Fermi surface that's in this region where there is no spin density wave order, but there is structural distortion. So this direction and this direction are now inequivalent. If I do that, then the circles that originally existed here now look like ellipses. I can perform the same kind of business. And now I get a slightly different scattering pattern, but once again doesn't look very much like the experiment. Okay? And fundamentally, it's quite simple to understand why both of these things will not work. When you have continuous Fermi surfaces that look like this, that look like circles or ellipses, these are going to produce continuous shapes for me in the scattering pattern. And what we instead see is we see some well-defined areas of high intensity which are separated from the central region by some distance. Okay, so what else can we do? We've looked at the Fermi surface in this region. We've looked at the Fermi surface in this region. The actual experiment was done down here, so it stands to reason that we should use the Fermi surface that corresponds to that particular temperature. And if you do that, let me take you through that particular calculation. So imagine I start with a Fermi surface which corresponds to the Fermi surface at high temperature. This is in the tetragonal and paramagnetic state. And I impose on this spin density wave order. Spin density wave order doubles the unit cell along one particular direction. So what this does is this takes this band and folds it onto gamma. So it takes the band that was here, it folds it onto gamma. These two bands can hybridize at these points. They can create gaps and produce a Fermi surface that looks like this. And now you see that I have Fermi surfaces that have the property that I desire. They have little pieces that are disconnected from each other. And when I scatter from these little pieces of Fermi surfaces, they're going to give me distinct spots in my scattering pattern. And so here is a calculation done for this particular Fermi surface. This is just a toy band model of the nictides, again done by Raphael in the days of his youth. And you can see that this is what one expects from this particular Fermi surface. This is what one sees in experiment. Both of them are actually the same scale, even though the scale isn't plotted here. And you see it has a pretty good match with what we see. You can even do the calculation directly in real space. So this is in real space in theory, this is real space in experiment. And it's a good match both in real and Fourier space. And I should say that alternative explanations for this phenomenon do exist, including things that are related to the actual defect site itself. Okay, so since then, we've done some improved calculations. And this is by Raphael's student, Xiao Yu, who I think is somewhere in the audience. So what Xiao Yu did is he took a more realistic model of the nictides. So this is a four-band Fermi surface based upon ZX Chen's ARPES results. And then he turned the crank and he did the same calculation. And now you can see that the agreement is even better. This is experiment, this is theory. And this is now the Fourier transform of experiment, Fourier transform of theory, keeping both the phase as well as the magnitude of the Fourier transform, and everything works out beautifully. The phases, everything comes out right. So we are quite happy with this. We think that this is a simple explanation for the anisotropy that we see in the experiment. Now, one can ask, this was for one particular sample. This was for a sample done down here. You can ask, what do these patterns look like at different parts in the phase diagram? We've now gone exhaustively through the phase diagram, and we've looked at these patterns. And I just point out patterns at a few different places on the phase diagram. The basic point that I want to make is that one sees anisotropy basically extend across the phase diagram, and we only see this anisotropy go away when the samples become non-superconducting. Now, is that a precise statement? No, because we need to take a lot more data here to ask exactly when it disappears. But certainly, as you go all the way from here to here, you see anisotropy persist in these Fourier transforms all the way till you get near the end of the phase diagram. Okay? You also see that these distinct little patches which are disconnected exist pretty much all the way across the phase diagram. Now, of course, the details of these patterns look a little different from each other. That's because the Fermi surface is evolving as one dopes this material, for example. But in all of these cases, we believe that this basic phenomenon, this phenomenon that you have disconnected pieces, has a simple explanation in terms of spin order or spin fluctuations. Okay, so when I was sitting down here at low temperature, I did have spin order in my sample. So it clearly made sense to use a Fermi surface that had spin order in it. You can certainly ask the question, what sense does it make to use a spin ordered Fermi surface to explain data that's here or here or here or here? And for this, we take a page out of famous transport experiments. So transport experiments have shown that even above the structural transition, even though one doesn't have spin order or pneumatic order, one certainly has strong pneumatic fluctuations. So there is a very strong pneumatic susceptibility that exists all the way in this phase diagram. So let me now hypothesize and say I have spin fluctuations, but not static spin order on my sample. And let me ask what that would do for STM experiments. And since I'm an experimentalist, I have a very simple-minded view of what spin fluctuations do to my STM experiment. Now, this is the spin-ordered Fermi surface. I imagine spin fluctuations in this very simple-minded form. Spin fluctuations are going on and off. The Fermi surface is going on and off between no spin order and spin order. And me, being an STM probe, which is very, very slow, I'm doing a time average of this phenomenon. And so if I do a time average of this phenomenon, I see basically what I see, which is an average of spin order and no spin order in my sample, okay? That's it. This is my competence, so that's what we'll do. Now, we've, of course, looked at this carefully as a function of temperature. So this is for the undoped sample as a function of temperature. And indeed, what we find is if we look at the intensity of these features, intensity of what we see in the STM, we clearly see that the intensity of the features dies away very sharply. And as you come very, very close to the spin density wave transition, which is at 40 Kelvin in this sample, you see a clear kink in the data as you go through the spin density wave transition. So everything that we see in the STM experiment is perfectly consistent with this idea that at high temperature or at high doping, one doesn't have static spin order in the sample. Instead, one has spin fluctuations, and these spin fluctuations are affecting the Fermi surface in this simple-minded way. Chandra is itching to ask a question.
You have to assume something about the frequency scale.
That's right. So the frequency scale has to be, I guess, fast enough so that we don't see it in STM, right? That's easy. But I guess it has to be slow enough that one can imagine the electrons doing this thing. So electron reorganization is on the scale of, you know, femtoseconds. So I would guess any fluctuation time scale that's between picoseconds and microseconds would work fine. Yeah. Okay, good. So I won't repeat this over and over. So I see that I'm already late. So we will speed up. Now we will take our sample, which we think we understand. Okay. We think we understand what the normal state of this material looks like, and we will try to impose superconductivity on this sample. Okay, good. So first, I will show you results from a sample that are down here in this region of the phase diagram. We know from other measurements, and in fact from our own measurements, that there is static spin order in this sample. And the sample is also weakly superconducting. So the superconducting TC is on the order of 10 Kelvin or so. Good. And how do we know that there's static spin order in the sample? Whenever there's static spin order in the sample, we always see domains. So domains, because I have to pick one of two possible orientations, we see these beautiful domain boundaries. And these domain boundaries actually give us a nice knob, because along the domain wall boundary itself, pneumatic order is zero or suppressed. Whereas as you go into the domain, there is strong pneumatic order. And so one can go with the STM and ask, where does superconductivity exist in this sample, which is pneumatically ordered? And indeed, what we see, so this is a domain wall boundary. Sometimes it looks dark and sometimes it looks bright. It's an electronic feature. If we look in the interior of this domain, you see that you see a big gap. This gap is actually associated with the spin order in the sample. Whereas if you look exactly on the domain wall boundary, you see a nicely developed superconducting gap. And as you go from here to here, you of course smoothly interpolate from one extreme to the other extreme. I should say that similar sorts of things have been seen now in many probes. So there's direct diamagnetism evidence of this sort of thing. There's also other nice STM experiments and so on. So the picture here in this part of the phase diagram is when I have static pneumaticity doesn't like superconductivity. Now let me ask a very different question. Let me go to this part of the phase diagram at optimal doping, where I never see domains in my sample. And I know from other measurements that there is no static pneumatic order. And I take a sample and I go through TC and I ask what happens to this sample as I go through TC. And what we'll do, of course, is we'll take big STM images. So here is a typical STM image. And I'll show you only the Fourier transforms because I don't want to show you too much data. And just to set your scale, the largest superconducting gap here at optimal doping for this particular compound is about 5 millivolts. And Eric is the one who did these experiments. Okay, so I'm just going to show you some Fourier transforms. On the left is the superconducting state. On the right is the normal state. This is about 15 degrees or so above TC. And here is the energy. So minus 18 millivolts is 18 millivolts below the Fermi level. Superconducting, normal. And I'm just going to play this as I go through from minus 18 to plus 18 or so. Okay, very good. So I'm just playing this a couple of times. So point one is, of course, they're different. Right? Sample has gone superconducting, you expect some difference. So let me pick on two particular differences and try to point them out to you. The first difference is, if you look at energies that are inside the superconducting gap, so here 4 millivolts, here you look at the superconducting state. On the right-hand side, you look at the normal state. You'll see that the superconducting state, again, has these little regions of intensity which look quite disconnected, here, 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 and here, here, and here also. Right? What are these due to? In this case, they're due to superconductivity. So how can we understand that? So let's go back to our Fermi surface. And let me pick only one of the bands of this crystal. Let me pick this particular band and zoom in here. If I open up a superconducting gap, and this superconducting gap is isotropic everywhere on this pocket, then of course the pocket disappears if I'm inside the gap and there's nothing to scatter electrons. If, on the other hand, the gap is anisotropic as you go around the pocket, then you will hit certain energies where in some regions of the pocket the gap has disappeared, and in other regions of the pocket, there might be a gap, right? And if you do that, once again, you'll have scattering vectors that correspond to distances from here to here. This will produce for you spots in your Fourier transform. Indeed, something very similar has been seen quite recently. This is in iron selenide. You can see a Fourier transform here. In the superconducting state, you can see the nice similarity between this and this. And a very similar explanation for this was given, that you have an anisotropic gap in the pocket, and anisotropic gaps provide for you these distinct scattering vectors. Okay, so that's interesting, and I think we still need some help in trying to understand the details of this, and I think they're very interesting in to try to understand the details. But the thing that really strikes me about this data, which we took a few times to convince ourselves that it's really right, So here I show you the comparison at 14 millivolts. This is at 14 millivolts, is twice the size of the superconducting gap or larger. At this kind of energy, I expect superconductivity is not playing any role really in these pictures. Right? It's all below this energy. If you look at the superconducting state, and you just look at this picture, and you look at the normal state, and you just look at this picture, you see something very clear. The superconducting state has broken four-fold symmetry, much stronger than the normal state. And that's weird. And in fact, if you go through and look at all of these energy slices, you'll see the same thing. You'll see that the anisotropy is actually stronger in the STM experiment in the superconducting state. So that's really, in my mind, one of the key findings that we have. At low temperature in the superconducting state, anisotropy is stronger. And one can ask, why is this? Of course, one thing that's happening is that the temperature is actually lowering. And one might imagine that it's just a temperature effect. The fluctuations are somehow becoming stronger as you lower the temperature. We've looked at samples that are further doped, overdoped, and we don't see the same effect when superconductivity is weak. So as far as we can tell, it really looks like it's something associated with superconductivity. Right? Now, I do need to take a little more data and actually fill up this temperature line as I go from here to here, which is something we're in the process of doing, to understand where exactly these anisotropy picks up. Okay. But I can always indulge in idle speculation. And my idle speculation is that superconductivity has to affect either the time scale for the fluctuations or the strength of the fluctuations themselves. And I don't know how. Okay, so now we're here at the third half of my talk, and I have 5 minutes left and 3 minutes left. I will steal 2 minutes. Okay, so I will go very quickly through this. So we now know that, so here is a transport experiment, or I think magnetism experiment. So if you have something that's anisotropic, an anisotropic electronic phenomenon, and you want to somehow control this phenomenon, one natural tuning parameter is strain. Because the strain picks one particular direction in the crystal, and you can orient these things along the direction that you choose by applying strain. So what we did is we built a jig where we can apply strain and look at the sample in the STM while we're applying strain. And this is done by Amy Notice. So to give you two highlights of what we can do with this, in the pneumatically ordered state, we can apply strain and we can move pneumatic domain boundaries around. So this is a domain boundary. And as we apply strain, we can actually move this domain boundary around, just like you can move a ferromagnetic domain boundary with a magnetic field. The more interesting thing is if you go to a sample which has pneumatic fluctuations, what we found we can do is we can apply strain to the sample and actually get rid of the pneumatic fluctuations. So what this tells us is that in the sample, there is a strain field that exists, not unreasonable if you've grown a sample. This strain field actually orients the pneumatic fluctuations in the absence of any external strain. And if you apply external strain that's just right, then you can cancel this internal built-in strain and get rid of this. One of the very, very interesting things that we found while doing this is the following. If you imagine what strain does as a parameter to determine what fluctuations are doing, imagine I have fluctuations that are along a particular direction, and they might also exist along the orthogonal direction. And imagine that there is no strain in my sample, then one expects that the net effect one sees in a slow probe is the average of these two phenomena. So one expects to see this plus this. If now you turn on a little bit of strain, the fluctuations along one direction are weakened. That's what my cartoon is supposed to show. The fluctuations along the other direction are strengthened. And so one expects to see an asymmetry. So this is what one expects. But in fact, this is not what we see in the experiment. If you take a picture at a finite amount of strain, then at zero strain, what we expect to see is the average of this picture and the 90 degree rotated picture. So we expect to see this at zero strain. But this is not what we see in the experiment. Instead, we actually see the amplitude of this feature go to zero. So we see that as we take the strain off, the amplitude of the feature, everything just goes away to zero. Okay? So what this tells us that in the nictides, the presence of strain not only picks a direction for the fluctuations, it actually controls the strength of the fluctuations as well. Right? And this is quite non-linear and non-intuitive to me. Okay, so in the time that I don't have, I'll say as an experimentalist, once you get into something, you just want to push it to its limit. With my old strain apparatus, I could do 0.2% strain, and I said, we need to make enough strain so we can blow samples apart. And so that's what we've been doing. We can now do any amount of strain you want. We can blow stuff apart. Just to show you cool things we can do with this. So here is another intertwined system, very classic system, niobium diselenide, charge density wave and superconductor. By applying 0.5% strain, we can tune TC by 50%. Oh, 1 minute left. Oh, I'm still doing good. We can tune TC by about 50% downwards, and it's quadratic. This is quite different from pressure. Pressure tunes the TC upwards by 20%. And so I think anisotropic strain seems to be quite different from pressure, seems to be a new tuning knob whenever you have the possibility of anisotropic phenomena in solids, something that we're quite excited about. Okay, so I've actually done my job. I've finished on time. These are my students who have been involved in this work. Shout out to Rafael and Xiaoyu. Samples come from Changxin Jin's group, who's been fantastic. And Andy Millis is my boss at Columbia. So thank you for your time.
I had a comment, mm-hmm. which is that this is about the relation between nemoticity and superconductivity. Mm-hmm. On symmetry grounds, if you ask what happens to superconducting state as you turn on a little bit of nemoticity, mm-hmm. TC is quadratic, obviously, in the nematic order parameter, and so small, but the gap anisotropy, so the gap in one direction will go up linearly in the nematic strain, and in the other direction will go down. So it's quite possible spectroscopically, in particular if you have a K-resolved spectroscopy, to see a very big effect and always positive effect of nemoticity on superconductivity, even though the effect on TC could first place be of either sign, but will be much smaller.
I see. Great, thank you for that.
Is the second half of your talk also information gathered through interference scattering of defects?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's only theorists asking questions. In your talk, suppose you show that when the system is in the orthorhombic and anti-ferromagnetic region, then you see in a large field of view all those features point in the same direction, and then
no, there's domains when it's orthorhombic.
Right. You know, within the domain. Right?
Within the domain.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you commented that in the phase at high temperature in which the system is tetragonal and there's no, a spin order, and you postulate that the fluctuations might cause anisotropic feature too. In that case, do you also see in a large field of view, all the features are pointing in the same direction?
Yes.
But that's very unnatural. It is caused by dynamic fluctuation.
I think it's because the strain field in the sample is over a very, very large length scale.
Okay, so
change.
But dynamic fluctuation effect and the strain induced the local, nematicity is very different.
But strain, I mean, when you say local, the strain is a strain field that varies very slowly in the sample, right? So it's like you've applied a magnetic field and everywhere it's pointing in the same direction. So I don't think it's unreasonable to expect the fluctuations to all be pointing along that
direction. Yeah, I guess your usage of fluctuation is slightly different from
So what I should say is the anisotropic phenomenon that we see appears always in the same direction, except sometimes we do get samples where we see local strain fields.
Right, so I understand.
If you look at bad samples, we
I understand if you have a finite pneumatic susceptibility, then any time you have a strain, you would induce some non-zero amount of pneumaticity. Mm-hmm. But how about a magnetism?
Okay, so what we see is just an anisotropic phenomenon in the STM, right? So I should not say that we directly measure magnetism in the sample. We just measure an anisotropic feature in the STM.
Lots of magnetism, a lot of neutron scattering experiments under.
Yeah, so Peng Cheng has some experiments on.
Hi. So I have the question is that do you know what kind of defect is it? Like, is it discarnation or it is like?
No, these are point defects. For the most part, they're sodium vacancies because sodium tends to be quite mobile. But we also have iron side defects. One of the key points that allows us to go with this scattering interpretation is that what we see is independent of the type of defect. So independent of what defect it is, it pretty much always produces the same pattern. So we neglect individual defect physics because we see it from all defects.
I guess what I wanted to ask is partly answered, but let me ask anyway. Somehow playing the role of devil's advocate. At some time of point of your talk, striped magnetic fluctuation transferred into pneumatic fluctuations. Mm-hmm. But you started by saying that basically everything is due to striped magnetism or striped magnetic fluctuation. So question for your particular samples, if you go away from antiferromagnetism, is there a real evidence that magnetic fluctuations remain strong?
Yes, I do believe that in Peng Cheng's experiments, neutron, that's the one that I'm familiar with, they have seen evidence for this.
Even if you go away from crossing between magnetism?
I think so, yeah. So at least what I can say is that if you don't assume something that folds the Fermi surface, it's difficult to explain what we see on the basis of scattering, right? Now, one can have other things that fold the Fermi surface, not just magnetism.
In the same system, the 111 system, Gersh-Bloomberg saw in very much in the same region a sharp resonance in the Raman scattering that you can naturally interpret as a bound state formed of a pneumatic fluctuation and a Bogoliubov quasi-particle. Mm-hmm. So given all your underlying strain, inhomogeneity, and so forth, it seems natural that in such environments this bound state would mix with the actual spectrum, so it could well be an explanation for the enhancement of the pneumatic behavior in the superconducting state. That's a very sharp feature that you see once you open a superconducting gap.
I see. I don't really understand that, so I will ask you more. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that your appeal to the SDW reconstructed Fermi surface in order to explain the isolated spots that you see in the pattern is appealing, but that this issue of why QPI patterns show isolated spots rather than linear features is an old one that came up in the cuprates as well. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think Jan here has just written a paper devoted to this question. It's not a trivial one.
Yeah. So
And I want to say that I personally think that there are microscopic explanations for why you see this, and that you need a more detailed description of the intra-unit cell scattering in order to understand that phenomenon.
Okay. So
we can discuss that if you want.
I did read that paper with quite some interest. So I think if I could point out one of the important things which you have pointed out quite a long time ago is when you have a bunch of defects in the sample, then the scattering processes are in general quite complex and they can give you, peaks where one doesn't expect peaks associated with a single defect. in these, at least in these things, at zero doping, we can really see isolated single defects. We can zoom in around a single defect, and all of that stuff can be done around a single defect. So as far as scattering goes, we can really go to the limit of one defect and look at scattering from that. And all of these things still continue to work. But this is, so there was another, so then maybe I'm not quite familiar with what you're talking about. We should talk, yeah.
In the quasi-particle interference, you mentioned that, this actually might be related to the previous question, these extra blips, these features, are a result, you said, of the anisotropy on the hole, on the electron pocket. In some materials like iron selenide, they claim that it's a sign-changing pocket, or the gap changes sign between pockets, where it's plus in one and minus in the other. Mm-hmm. And that, so it's not, so I know it's a different material, but would that still give rise to those same features, the same quasi-particle interference features, where it's plus on one ellipse and minus on the other, rather than being plus, then minus, then plus on one ellipse?
Yeah, so my understanding is that these things might affect the phase of scattering around a defect, but if one just looks at what wave vectors are allowed for scattering, then if one has an anisotropic gap, there would be some energy range in which some parts of the Fermi surface are gapped out. Some parts of a given pocket are gapped out and some parts are not. And as soon as one has that, so this is the case in cuprates, for example, then one has very clear spots because there's regions of high intensity which connect those ends of where the gaps exist. And you know, this goes back to a long time. Yeah.
Maybe this is like what Peter asked, but what about the orbital orbital weight on the Fermi surface. Mm-hmm. Is it also possible that the missing pieces that you're talking about could be because your tip is sensitive to scattering of one type of orbital? So the orbital weight on the Fermi surface could be also reflected.
So this is certainly an interesting possibility. And in other materials, we have seen such selectivity, you know. What I can say is that we did look at this. This goes back to when Raphael was looking at this. He looked at this quite carefully. And one would have to make some ad hoc assumption for either what the scattering potential is or how your tip is picking out particular things, which might be the case, but with the spin order situation, we didn't have to do anything. It just fell out and all the wave vectors matched and everything was good. Yeah.
Hey, now exactly back on schedule.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so.